Right. Well, we're going to be throwing questions from. We're going to have questions from you in a moment. But as I always say, I've got the microphone, so I go first. But what really struck me about the three sort of presentations, thinking about inequality and the health gap, is Michael mentioned three things: welfare, housing, and jobs, occupation. Duncan made a very clear point about it's not about money. There's sort of 600 billion quid, potentially. Well, maybe I'm getting my maths wrong, but it was a lot. It was a lot of hundreds of billions, anyway, in the voluntary sector, in the health sector, in allied work. And then we heard from Jane, who started off and said, we're having all these cuts, money's really tight in health. So I just wonder, before we move on to the sort of Q&A with the audience here, Michael, first of all, is it about money? And if it is about money, where should the money be spent? Are we too focused on thinking it's a health inequality, therefore we need to spend the money on health?
Well, let's take the
Yep.
The question about money, which I've spent a lot of time thinking about money and health. At the lower end, people below the minimum income threshold, if individuals don't have enough money to feed their families, to pay for housing, to heat their housing, so fuel poverty, problems of housing, problems of food, at the low end, lack of money is damaging people's health, no question about it, for the individuals.
Sure.
When we get below that, above that threshold, for countries as well as for individuals within countries, it continues to be the case that your position in the hierarchy is related to your health. It's a gradient, but it can't simply be about money. And the importance of money to the individual depends crucially on what the community provides. I saw a figure a while ago that for the bottom 10% of Americans, 40% of household income was spent on running a car. And you'd think, why would they do such a thing? Why would you spend 40% of your household income on running a car? Well, if there's no bus, how are you going to get the kids to school, get somebody to hospital, move around?
Are we looking at the wrong thing then, Michael? Where our priority lies. You're talking about public transport, you're talking
absolutely.
About housing, you're talking about welfare, and yet the health sector just says, look, we'll sort this, but you just have to give us enough cash. Are they wrong?
They're not wrong. I mean, as you know, our spend on health was around 6% of GDP, which was at the bottom end of rich countries. We got it up to about 9%, and we've now slipped back to below 7%. So we're clearly not spending enough on healthcare. We look very badly compared with other rich countries. So to get it back up to the 9%, well, we got
you want more money spent on health, but in terms of dealing with health inequalities, your entire presentation seems to be suggesting actually we need to be looking at welfare, housing, and jobs.
Well, because I'm not allowing you as a BBC person to say, is it one or the other? Because it's both. And what I'm trying to say is that we need to get our healthcare expenditure back up to the rich country average, the European
right.
average, which would be, it's now up at around 10%. But if we got it back to 9%, it's been slipping back down. It got up to 9%, now it's going down. We need to spend more on healthcare. That said, we need to invest in the social determinants of health. That actually, I quoted that figure, that 31% of families with children were below the minimum income threshold. That's gone up to 39%. We've stopped spending on social housing.
Okay.
We don't spend enough on education. So that And there's a lot of money sloshing about, and that's what.
But this is Duncan's point. And Duncan, you were shaking your head or nodding actually when I was suggesting that maybe we're spending it on the wrong thing. That we should be spending it more on the things that Mike mentioned, and not spending a great deal more on health.
I'm just conscious of time. It's both and. I buy into Michael and I have from the outset. It's both and. But obviously, we need a strong NHS. But it's not enough. It won't ever make the difference. It can't, because the NHS doesn't create jobs that people can get, pay decently so people have enough money to live on. It can't sort out fat kids at age 11. It can't sort out reading standards at age 11 that tell you everything about the rest of life. It's about not conflating health, and we do it all the time, and if it's not clear, it does my head in. That we keep conflating good health with the NHS as if these things are, if you like, sufficient, and they're not. And it's not just the BBC, it's everybody does it. They talk about health and the NHS as if they are exactly the same thing, and they are not. I was in Sierra Leone a couple of weeks ago. Now, if we want to know about absolute poverty, go there. There's a wharf in Freetown, King Harry Wharf, several hundred people living in absolute poverty, outside, but they're organised, they have a committee, they meet, they've got a chairman and all of this. In the course of the epidemic of Ebola, not one resident of that wharf died. Not one. Why? Because of community organisation, caring for and about each other, making sure that everybody washed their hands, that nobody was put at risk. Somewhere in this debate, we've got to move on from talking about not enough money. Now, I very purposefully did not talk about the health service and the 20% of waste in the health service, where the medical director of the NHS says either does no good or does positive harm. 20%. The variation is unbelievable. 80% of diabetic care in a hospital is avoidable. That's not me saying it, that's the World Health Organization. If we do not take the opportunity to think about what we're getting for our money, we'll continue to say, and the answer is more. And then we're back to the Chancellor. I think the issue for us is to look at what we've got and how are we getting the most out of it. It's both and. It's just not enough. It's intellectually incomplete to say that you know, it's just about more money.
Okay, I want to move on to Jane in a second. Thank you for that. I mean, I absolutely take your point, and please, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't spend more money on health. I'm making the point, actually, which I make in terms of crime. People make the same view about this. They say, what's happening with crime is related to how much money we spend on the police. Absolutely not. The two things, yes, with no correlation whatsoever. And I think that the same point with health and the NHS. But Jane, there's the challenge in a way, is that clearly you're having to make an argument about actually we need a well-funded NHS. But if we're going to deal with health inequality, do we need our health professionals to be perhaps a little bit more open and honest? And we were talking about social prescribing in Bromley. Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe we need the health service as a whole, and physicians included, to think a lot more about their responsibility to do more than give a fiver to the guy in the sleeping bag outside the church.
That's absolutely right. However, we need to get from here to there, and we can't get from here to there without some kind of investment in the service, because with a demoralised workforce, with a service that's dealing with stable doors that are already shut and bolted horses, we have to be able to treat the patients that turn up in front of us. And in order to turn that around, we need investment. And at the moment, the GDP that this country is spending on health is below equivalent nations. I'm not suggesting that forever we need to have more money for the health service, but we need to learn how to do things differently. And if you're demoralised, if all you're doing in your A&E department, which is what happens to my colleagues, is seeing 40, 50, 60 patients over a 24-hour period and trying to get them out of there within 4 hours to somewhere, you're less efficient than you should be. So you need to invest in order to be able to do things more effectively. Okay. And at the moment, we're just running on a hamster wheel.
All right, okay, so I want to move on from straight NHS funding, if I may, but certainly take some questions from the floor. Lady there, gentleman over there, and then a gentleman on the far side.
Okay, thank you. I'm Angela Burnett from Freedom From Torture, and I wanted to pick up, Michael, on the Thai triangle that moves mountains, and to say that we must use our voice together as the people, using the knowledge and evidence that we already have, to ensure that we have health promoting policies in every single government department. I think it's an issue of social justice, but also it makes sense economically. At the moment, we overspend on the arms trade, and which fuels war, refugees, and poverty. Overspending on prisons, and I think we need to reduce inequalities. We know that. Invest in reducing child poverty, invest in education, a radical housing policy that ensures there's enough decent housing for everyone, and progressive tax. And I think really, if we did all those things as a country, I think the evidence shows that things would improve.
Okay.
Am I right?
Well, we'll get some answers in a minute. I can take a few questions, if I may. I think probably the answer is going to be yes. But anyway, the gentleman here.
I'm Al Storia. Most people have heard me rant already. A couple of weeks ago, on a rather grey day, I was at another funeral for a client. He had been found by our service. He had MDR-TB, been cured. Unfortunately, he was beaten to death. He was unconscious in the Royal Free for several months. And it was me, someone from my service, and someone from Groundswell who were in the audience at the funeral. I just thought to myself, this guy just typifies what we do. And I think, while it's nice to have a debate about having the Chancellor's number on speed dial, most of the people in this room work with one person at a time. We find people at the bottom, and we try and fix them one at a time. In terms of the money debate, sure, there's a lot of money out there, but I want to go right back to Michael's inspirational concepts of proportional universalism. I want to think about the fact that we can evidence very clearly that we're working with a population who are extremely vulnerable and disenfranchised, and we've got some very good evidence to suggest some of the earlier statistics about their health service usage were wrong. Most of them are, in fact, very low-end users of the health service. So, Michael, how can we bring to bear some of the evidence around proportional universalism to get a little bit of the cash to the front end of the service where we work to actually try and make a little bit of a difference to the people who are truly in need.
Okay, thank you for that. Yep. I thought that might go down well. There's a gentleman over there, one of our experts by experience.
Hi, I'm Stan, nice to know me as well. I just think that one of the biggest problems are, we talk about inclusion, is the fact that people on the margins are very often expected to wrap around the health service and get better when healthcare really should wrap around the patient. There's lots of evidence to demonstrate that actually if you start tackling someone's health and help them to deal with that and at the same time provide a safety net or a safety provision within the social care structure, what you end up doing is you end up providing a cost-positive patient. They don't enter, they're healthier, they don't access healthcare systems as often, they find themselves in employment where they're paying taxes back in. I'm in agreement with our story in the fact that tips of money at the top end to create more of these things and the repayments become perpetual. You will find more people coming through being less dependent on the system. And health outcomes, as you pointed out regarding the place you went to in Sierra Leone, are community-based. If you start feeding positives within a community-based system of the homeless, the marginalised, that picks up, and that does happen, and it's a follow-on through. So I'm all over there with that bit.
Okay, great. Unanimity seems to have broken out among the audience anyway. Duncan, you were nodding a lot at that last point, particularly thinking about making sure the money works at the front end.
Well, I mean, I travel a lot in England, and I'm in three or four places a week, and I get to meet voluntary bodies and third sector people, I get to meet the NHS and local government, and I see an awful lot of good being done. I see a great deal of innovation, and the sort of money we're talking about for the sort of thing that, you know, the community development is next to nothing in it. I mean, the investment next year, unless anybody misunderstands, we need a strong NHS, but, you know, next year we're putting another 3,800 million into the NHS. I prefer to say 3,800 million because I think 3.8 billion doesn't sound enough. And, you know, if we take that amount and we just say, what could a little bit of that do? Now, I said we didn't need another strategy, but there's a conversation going on around the country. It's just about to kick off about a prevention plan in each part of the country. This will be the first time that the NHS and local government coming together are being asked to consider what will they do over the next 3 to 4 years to close the health gap. They won't do welfare reform, but they might do something about housing, transport infrastructure and so on. What would they do in about 44 parts of the country? And there'll be a health, so with a focus on the health, not the efficiency in, or the quality about the variation in healthcare, but actually the health gap. So not thinking that your bed's in a hospital, but your bed's at home if you're fortunate, where you sleep at night, to wrap around the individual. So I'm looking over the course of the next 3 to 4 months to see what all the different parts of the country are going to be saying about closing the health gap. And inclusion, health and homelessness will be part of that.
Yeah.
The sort of investment that we'll be looking at will not be huge amounts of money, but I think it's the sort of money that could make a difference. Mm.
Can I just say that when you are looking at closing the gap, make sure you don't shut people out when that gap is closed.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. I know I'm being saying is it's not about, you know, like the troubled families issue. They say the trouble is the family and they just don't fit our system, you see. And that's the problem, so they get excluded. And if you say, well, actually, it's the family and we're the problem, and how you work with them, then you can get a different sort of... what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of good work out there, or it's about how do we share it better and shine more light on it. And the voice of the people is hugely important in this.
Jane, I'm just thinking about the point that the first of our questioners asked. Health promoting policy in every government department. And we do have a very siloed system of governance, which means that the Department of Health often goes into battle against other departments for resources. And this is madness, isn't it? I mean, this is exactly Duncan's point, and indeed Michael's point, about how we often are missing the real place that we need to put our efforts in to deal with health inequality.
I think that's right, and I think people, though, have now recognised over areas like obesity, take an example. So obesity is a health inequality problem. It's a problem of children, so perhaps... education, Department of Education ought to be looking at obesity. It's a problem of the food industry. So maybe the Treasury ought to be looking at a sugar tax. Hey, what a revolutionary idea. The Ministry, what is it, the sports, culture, media and sports ought to be increasing the number of places there are where people can take more exercise. So there are some core health crises where government departments are beginning to start to link across and talk to each other. But we're all guilty of the same thing. We all work in silos and we've all got to link across. I just wanted to say something else though about the comment that you made about dealing with one person at a time. Because one of the issues about dealing with one person at a time is that you provide fantastic care for that person. But I think we, as a responsible series of healthcare leaders, need to recognise that we need alignment of thought, and that if we stand back and think of the bigger picture and think of the policy levers that we could be changing, then actually we'll be doing more for more people than if we only ever focus on one person at a time. So my call to people is absolutely don't reduce the quality of the care you give to one person at a time. But do remember that there's a bigger picture, and that getting involved in policy and leadership around these areas can help to change the lives for more people at a time. But it means standing back from where you are now.
I'm aware of that, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. Yeah, I want to bring in Michael, and I take some more questions, but Michael, just on this, is that the same point really about sort of the idea that we embed health-promoting policy or reduction of health inequalities or however we want to describe it right across Whitehall, that almost every policy is measured in terms of how effective it is, not just in pushing up GDP, but in terms of actually dealing with making our society more equal?
Yeah. Can I tell you a little story?
Please,
a little
briefly.
Story. Briefly. I was, and I'm always looking for allies, and I was introduced to the managing partner of one of the big management consultancy firms, and I was thinking maybe pro bono they could help us. And he said, when you go into a country, do you have resources to offer that country? And I said, no resources. He said, do you have a cadre of trained people you could offer them? Not really. He said, what can you offer a country? I said, the opportunity and the evidence to improve health and well-being of their population. And he looked at me, he said, you really do need help. Well, I tell this story, I mean, firstly, if you think politics is dysfunctional in this country, just look across the Atlantic. They trump our bad politics, sorry. But I think what we're talking about, and comes back to proportionate universalism, thank you, is what you think you're about as a politician. The evidence is that universalist systems function better to improve health for everybody. That's what we've learned from looking around the world. But the worst off need extra investment. That's what the evidence shows. Why is not everybody acting on that? Well, I don't know. We need more BBCs. We need more people to get the evidence across. I push the evidence. We need allies who are advocates, activists, who says this is what the evidence shows. But what we're talking about is that health and health inequalities are a very good measure of how well our society is doing. We know we're not doing as well as we might because our health is not as good as it might be, and the health inequalities have not been narrowing. So we know we're not doing as well as we might be. Now, to come back to the question, do we have the resources? Because that's the other thing we're told. No, we've got to get the public finances in good order and the economy and so on. And two comments on that. First is that whereas after the global financial crisis, macroeconomists were perhaps in equipoise about austerity versus Keynesianism. That is no longer the case. The IMF, the OECD surveys of macroeconomists in the US show overwhelmingly that macroeconomists are Keynesian. The wrong approach to growing your economy when you're in trouble is more austerity. Not all, but that's the mainstream of economics. Then we ask, well, why have we been doing the opposite? Why are we sending Greece down the plug hole? Why are we making things hard for Spain and Portugal, quite apart from the UK? Well, this obviously comes down to ideology. It's flying in the face of the evidence. And I think we have to work harder using health and health inequalities as our markers, not political ideology. But I say, I pretend that I'm not political, but I am concerned about health inequalities, and that's the marker. And we know, I mean, the Oxfam figures from a few weeks ago, what was the figure? 62 rich people have the same wealth as half the rest, the other 3.5 or 3.6 billion people in the world. And Tony Atkinson points out that the charmed position of the 1% in the US and the UK, the increased share of income that our top 1% has been getting, and the lower tax rate, is not the case in other rich countries. They don't do it like that in Switzerland, in Germany, in the Netherlands. That's not an economic necessity, that's a political choice. So we got to get the argument that there's a great deal of money out there, there are people in need. It's a marker of what kind of society we are. And I've argued in the US, Republican, Democrat, I couldn't care less. This is our children we're talking about. This is the most vulnerable people in our society. Are we going to use our resources to help those, or are we not? And that's a marker of how we're doing as a society.
Okay, I want to take a few more questions. Very strong, thank you. Wow, a sea of hands. Thank you. Gentleman just there. There's another. I thought there's another one. There's a lady over there as well. A lady there. Okay, those three.
Good afternoon. Donald Lane, expert by experience with Pathways. I'd just like to make a little observation and maybe a point. Is my experience from Norwich, where I'm from, I have many friends who are working and many who are unemployed and looking for work. But all of them are about three salaries away from being homeless, and I think that's a case rolled right out across England. And my point is, NHS England, if the NHS really is a jewel in the crown, why is there no minister or government body here to say, well done? I'm quite stunned that they're not here.
Okay, all right. Lady over there.
Hello, I'm Serena Lutensky. I'm a public health registrar, and I have a question for Duncan. You said we don't need any more strategies, and you asked the audience, what should we do? And you mentioned conversations that are happening between the NHS and local authorities around the country. What is public health doing? What are you doing as leader of the organization and my profession? I feel like public health is a bit lost in what they're doing and what their role is in contributing to public health, and I'd like to know what your plan is on that.
Okay, all right, the question just there, thank you.
I'm Sarah Pathways. One of the things is, it, I suppose for the last, 20 minutes or something, it's been all about money. But actually, I think a lot of it is about putting money in the right places. It's not about pumping billions into the NHS. Yeah, money's important, you can't buy stuff without it, but put it in the right places. And I'll give you a very, very quick example. You know, when I was really unwell, I spent nearly 3 years in hospital altogether in various psychiatric units. When I was 17, they put me in a private unit in Sussex, which is over 350 miles away from where I live. Probably even more than I can estimate, because I'm really bad at my distance. But they sent me down there. I wasn't ready for treatment. They sent me because they didn't know what to do and everyone had given up on me. So they'll have spent £650 a day, I think it is, sending me to a private unit, funding that place for 12 weeks. You know, when actually I didn't want to stop harming myself, so I wasn't going to use the skills that were being taught. I went down there because they told me it was the best thing to do. You know, now, it didn't help. I got worse. I turned 18. I suddenly turned into an adult overnight, as you do. Developed a personality disorder, again, overnight. But actually, you know, some of the things that helped were the people that cared, the people who showed empathy, compassion, you know. And now some of the things that help are getting involved, working with people like Pathways, like Stand Up Pathways, and working to try and improve services. And actually, now a lot of the things that help are peer support. And actually, not just peer support, but well-managed and well-supported peer support.
Okay. Well said. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, and a really important point. And Jane, I wanted to actually maybe pick that up with you. Empathy, compassion. We yesterday we were talking about, some of the experts by experience were talking about, particularly about how systems are sort of built around the needs of the provider of the system rather than the actual person who's receiving the services. And often this can, you know, can end up with, you know, the receptionist, the dreaded receptionist, just turning people away. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, we've talked about this in the context of nursing a lot, the idea of empathy and compassion after various crises. But I wonder, within the medical profession more broadly with doctors, do you think there's room for perhaps extra effort to try and improve the levels of compassion and empathy that they show?
I think most definitely. I think that most people who set out to become doctors feel that they are empathic, feel that they have compassion, and then they're put into a system where suffering is the norm. And in order to deal with the suffering that they see, sometimes they get a little bit of compassion fatigue. Yeah. On the whole, though, the majority of people that work in health, and I'm maybe a bit positive and Pollyanna-ish about it, the majority of people that work in health go in there because they want to help people. So if you go into a hospital and you have a problem, you will see people who have a genuine desire to help. But when you go into the hospital at 4 o'clock in the morning and you're patient number 59 of the 60 patients that they're going to have seen by then, and you're tired and you haven't had your break, then people do get compassion fatigue. And I know it shouldn't happen, but I think it does happen.
Okay, Duncan, there's a question specifically aimed at you. What is public health doing? What are your big strategies to try and answer the question that you posed for us all at the beginning?
So I think we need to focus on the health gap. I mean, what I'm interested in, and what I think the professional discipline needs to shift to, what is to concern about the public's health, not public health. If we're looking at public health and conventional ways, what I was trying to say at the beginning, there's a lot to be proud of, smoking in public places, seatbelt legislation, a range of different things to be, you know, we'll have a child obesity strategy, but it won't be a public health strategy, it'll be an all of government strategy. It will address advertising aimed at children, it will talk about the reformulation of food at source, it will be concerned about, you know, things like buy one, get one free and so on in supermarkets, that lead to people buying about a fifth more a week than they need. Some of this is leading to waste, but it's also leading to an increase in the waistline. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's a part of what public health is about. But the next generation of public health, or the public's health, will be concerned with the health gap and the inequalities, which is an apolitical question, okay? It is an apolitical question.
Available in good bookshops.
It doesn't matter. It is an apolitical question. And it's about getting out of the profession and the discipline, leaving the ego at the door and getting into the conversation about what's going to make the biggest difference. And we'll all have a bit of an angle on it, but Michael and I are closer than far apart about what matters here. And the fact that we can have a conversation is something that simply wasn't possible before. The fact that we've got an NHS thinking about three gaps, not just one gap, three gaps. It's thinking about a financial gap, a quality gap and a health gap is a step ahead for the public health, is the public health for the public health profession. So I lead the public health system. I'm caring for the public health profession, but it's not the point. And can I just say one other thing? I am not of the NHS, okay? So when you say I'm the 33rd most important person in the NHS, well, I'm amazed. Is that? It speaks to this bit about health in the NHS. But I am not, I'm concerned for health. I'm concerned for what it takes to improve the health of the people. That isn't just about the NHS, okay? It's such an important paradigm shift. It gets in the way. So the movement I need you folks to be, you know, more angry about is why we conflate these things so that we can have conversations about how we allocate and spend our money in ways that might make a bigger impact.
Okay. I'm going to ask Michael just to give some closing thoughts, perhaps on that particular point about how we think about health and avoid falling into the trap of thinking about the health service.
Well, let me tell you why I describe myself as an evidence-based optimist. The first is I look at the two respondents on this panel. In the past, public health people were talking pretty well only about giving up smoking or eating more sensibly. And here we've got the leader of Public Health England who is talking about improving society. And we've got the president of the Royal College of Physicians, the head of hospital doctors, essentially, talking about the importance of joining up with primary care and the community and social care and doing more on public health. That's really encouraging. And the second reason, to give you just one example, I was thinking when Duncan said he travels to different parts of the UK 3 or 4 times a week, some people have all the luck. I end up having to go to Istanbul and Bangkok and Tashkent and the like. I mentioned Istanbul before I went to this meeting on war, migration and health. They said, well, while you're coming, will you give a lecture to our medical school, which I did, and there were 450 people turned up. And the students at the end of it were so inspiring. I was mobbed by these students. Essentially, they said, we want to change the world. Tell us what we should be doing. And so I gave them my 5 things that I talked to the doctors about, which is education and training. So comes back to Jane's point. She said 91%, I think you said, of physicians know about the link between homelessness and health, but 95% said we don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So education and training. Number 2, is thinking about St. Pancras Church, is seeing the patient in the broader perspective. Number 3, and again it comes back to Jane's point, thinking of the health service as employer, the conditions of work, not just for junior doctors, but for nurses and lab assistants and cleaners and porters and the like, 1.3 million people, conditions of work. Number 4, crucially, is working in partnership. And you as a doctor or you as some other may not be able to provide housing. Work in partnership with those who can. Abuse children. You may not feel that you're equipped to deal with the abuse, but work in partnership with those who are. And the 5th, crucially, and this is my takeaway message, is advocacy. Get out there from a health point of view, from a health equity point of view, and advocate for the kind of social action that we need to create better health and narrower health inequalities.
Fantastic stuff. If you show your appreciation to Michael, to Duncan, and to Jane.